51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. It was all those arenas. I was going to make you a member of the family, Colm. You're going to be Colm Muckarena there for a little moment of time.
La Cucaracha.
Absolutely. Now, many people will know that the new documentary series called From That Small Island is going out on Sunday evenings on RTE One Television, charts the history of our beautiful island, starting right back with its first inhabitants, the hunter-gatherers, tens of thousands of years ago. The series is narrated by Mr. Colin Farrell, I'm told to call him, and in harmony with his dulcet tones telling the story is the score, composed by the musician and history buff, formerly known as Colm Muckarena, but now being referred to as Colm Muckarena from now on. Anyway, Colm Muckarena, let us stick with the correct version, Colm. This is an extraordinary project. I was just you sent us in an awful lot of the music in separate little files, which makes it easier for us, obviously, to play it. What is 20,000 years across 4 hours of television?
Yes,
that's a lot of music.
Yeah, it is a lot of music. And I suppose the nature of it being a whistle-stop journey through Irish history, I suppose necessitated that there would be a huge amount of music to aid the storytelling and to kind of keep things moving along, and also to be able to help the viewer process all of the information and kind of engage with this emotionally, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, and I suppose there's that thing that you could shift from the sparseness in many ways of the island. Yes, it was flourishing and loads of stuff was growing here, but without many inhabitants, there's a sparseness to that. But you're going to bring it right up through the famine period into the revolutionary periods, right up to the contemporary, to modern day and the peace process. There's a lot of styles and sounds that
you have
to put in there.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, I mean, it was definitely a labour of love. You know, I grew up in the, you know, early 70s as a, you know, well, you know, what was all a lot of action happening here and, you know, as an Irish speaker growing up in Dublin from earliest times, you know, I was asking myself and my parents, well, you know, how did this exactly happen that we are the only Irish speaking family on our road in Dublin? And to visiting grandparents and, you know, seeing my grandfather's IRA medal in a chest and next to it was his brother's, you know, British Army medals. So it's a very kind of complex history we have, you know, and
the historical side of things. I think that was always an interest for you, as you've just described there before. Even music was there. Would you have been an avid reader of history?
Oh yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, like I studied history before I, you know, ran away with the circus. I did a year in college. Yeah, so I very much enjoyed, you know, people like Hugh Gough in UCD. European history and stuff. Yeah, so like it's lovely. And growing up on those, you know, Robert Key documentaries in the 70s and 80s, you know, so and I was, you know, I would have been, you know, I remember, you know, I would have been first to get up. I've come from a big family, so, you know, having the house to yourself is a big thing. So I was an early riser and I'd be the first to get the paper, you know, and I'd read the paper before everybody else in the morning.
So there's a politician and an historian lurking in there somewhere, it sounds like to me. Let's listen to, and I think it's the best way to kind of illustrate a part of what you do here. And it was a moment in the first episode, I don't know how far into it is, maybe 9 or 10 minutes, something like that, into the first episode, when I really sat up and there's a shift in the tone and the music when we head off to the Cage of Fields, in fact, is the section that I have here. And in Mayo, obviously, UCD Professor Seamus Caulfield is kind of telling us about the history of that particular area and the people that lived there. Colin Farrell's narration is in there as well. And at the end of it all, the wonderful voice of Seamus Heaney.
In terms of world history, what we have here is an exceptionally early example of structuring the land into fields and controlled agriculture, if you like.
Underneath this vast area is a complete system of fields laid out by our first farmers and marked by stone walls. They remained hidden for thousands of years by the bog which grew over them.
I grew up a couple of hundred yards from here, and my father, Patrick Caulfield, when he was cutting turf in the 1930s on our own bog, just over a few hundred yards from here, he noticed lines of stones, and he recognized that he wasn't an archaeologist, but that they had to be older than the bog, therefore very ancient.
When he stripped off Blanket Bog, the soft piled centuries fell open like a glib. A landscape fossilized, its stone wall patternings repeated before our eyes in the stone walls of Mayo.
There we have a little clip from that small island, which is the new documentary series. Two episodes have already shown, I think, at this point on RTE, and they're available on the player. And the next two episodes come over the next two Sunday evenings. Colm McInamara, composer of the original score for the series, is with me in studio this evening. Just as I listened to that section, which is a minute and 16 seconds long or something like that, and there is that beautiful violin fiddle tune playing in the background, then you have the voice of Seamus Coughlin coming in, the soft, intimate tones of Colin Farrell. He really does speak directly to us. There's not a hint of performance in what he's doing.
It's funny because, before we were good, halfway through the project, before I heard Colin reading the voiceover. So it was very much, and I understood actually how important it would be. It's like kind of you're recording a song that there's the guide vocal and there's the actual take. So when his recording came in, then it was so intimate that I realized that, you're working with a kind of a way smaller kind of dynamic window. It definitely wasn't kind of a bombastic sort of, and then this happened so it's very engaging.
Yeah, it is. He really has a way of, you feel that you're being spoken directly to, and you're not getting a lecture on, a whole set of historical facts. You're really being told a story.
Exactly.
That's the way he seems to do it. You were saying that Seamus Coughlin.
Well, yeah, Seamus was, in that year in UCD, many year decades ago, I studied archaeology as well, so I would have learned all about the Beaker people with Seamus Caulfield.
So some of the stuff that you heard him saying
within
the series you must have heard before in a different context. And again, the voice of Seamus Heaney that comes in at the end there with the section from Bell Derg, one of the poems from the collection North, which incidentally is 50 years old this year as well, published 50 years ago, and we'll be celebrating that in a much bigger way. I think it's a Monday night's programme here on Arena. We'll be looking at that particular Heaney collection. Similar to a different voice from Colin Farrell, obviously, but a voice that has such rich sonority in it. You wouldn't want to be competing in any way with it.
Yeah, well, it's. I suppose my role is quite clear, I'm a servant to the story and facilitator. In that, it requires kind of humility. I mean, I don't think any musician necessarily enjoys somebody talking over their music.
Did they do that on radio? I'd say as well. I bet you they do.
But so I think you know what you're in for. He does it very well.
It's about supporting the thing rather than saying, look at me, listen to what I can do. It's not about that. It's making something bigger with all of the constituent parts within all of that. As you're saying it there, I mean, the fact that you hadn't heard Colin Farrell reading it seems extraordinary to me.
I did. I would have been working on the episodes and with, I think it was Peter, one of the directors was reading it, which he did well, but it was a different, very much a different take. It's an interesting back and forth, between the departments and you're definitely, it's like sailing, you're trimming the sail all the time to find the thing is, so when you're talking about something starting with a script and a list of shooting locations, and then
You haven't seen visuals either.
No,
at this
all. With this at all. No, and it was nice actually that I'd kind of, because I'd met Brianna 2 years ago and at a Ireland Funds dinner, and she approached me about this potential project, and understanding the way these things are and kind of how long the arc of the process takes. So you start with the general, so you create a file on the computer And then as ideas come in that might fit that brief, you put there. And it's then when you get closer, you move from the general to the specific then. Yeah.
And the Brainy you're talking about there is Brainy McDermott, who is
the writer of the piece.
It's not all quiet, reflective, gentle scenes either, because obviously you're going through battles
it's a maelstrom, really. Yeah,
let's have a listen to what you put into place for, I suppose, the only date I could ever remember, 10-14 for the Battle of Clontarf. I was hopeless on remembering dates, but I always remember that one. I have no idea why it stuck in my head. And here is the music that you have for that particular moment. Is part of the Battle of Clontarf, the music that Colm McInerney uses in the series from that small island. And it's interesting, as you were listening there, it's when the whistle comes in, the pre-existing tune. So you're totally your own composition at the top in that piano section and the little rhythmic pulse that's going on underneath it. Then it's Mark Redmond who plays the Brian Brew's march on the whistle.
Yeah, no, it was very satisfying being able to kind of draw on the bit of knowledge that I would have as regards the repertoire and being able to use pieces that are appropriate to the subject at hand. And so, for example, we used Brian Brew's march for the Battle of Clontarf, where Brian Brew was famously killed while in prayer by a Viking had strayed away from his from the line, and
he was in his tent, wasn't he?
He was in his tent, yeah, and so changed the course of Irish history. And then other moments, say where later on in episode 2 probably there's I use the same music, and we introduce the Battle of Aughrim. So that's around the Battle of Boyne and the Battle of Aughrim as well. Mm. And so that there's and the Brian Brew's march and the Battle of Aughrim have a kind of a face off as well. So there's lots of
and I guess that's a great way of having one part of history speak to another part of history.
And you know, in the queue before that, you have bits of, you know, the sash my father wore from the, you know, coming from the Siege of Derry into the Battle of the Boyne. So, you know, it's nice to give it that sense of authenticity as well.
And again, as you say, in many ways, that creates the period very quickly for us, because we know the tunes, even though we might have to think about where they come from.
For sure,
Very quickly, you hear the Sash My Father Wore, you're going to think of King Billy and the Battle of the Boyne. It's just going to happen fairly swiftly indeed. I love also, I suppose, the straightforward simplicity of what you did for the famine period. Let's have a listen first of all, and you can tell us how this came to your musical mind.
Here Ushlin of Las Gungaur aboard.
Minute and a half, but it's so powerful. That's Maeve Ní Beagla, isn't it? Maeve Beagla there with Páirtí Dua, a song from the famine period.
Yes, from the Waterford area, from Na Gaeilge. I wasn't familiar with the song beforehand. It was Brianna who brought it to my attention, and it just, you know, I think there's a lot to be, there's so much in the human voice to tell and to transmit a story and feeling. And, you know, so it was nice to for Maeve and for Maeve was such a beautiful and authentic Irish voice. So it was great to have her sing it.
Yeah, very. It just fits the whole thing. And I can see how you almost need no commentary.
Exactly, yeah.
Pictures of any kind, you know, relating to the famine underneath that song.
Yeah.
And it just tells
And I think actually they do... Bríd Ní Nachtain, actually, she reads a translation of each lyric in between each line in English, I think, as part of the...
Oh, it's the overall soundscape.
Yeah.
And there are other sections where, you know, what we've been listening to so far, certain you can hear the traditional Irish background to it. There are other times when you go into slightly different places. What are the guilds, or what story are you telling, or what story has been told in around this piece? Do you remember?
Which one?
Well, let's play it, and then you can when you hear it, you'll know which one I'm talking about.
Great.
This is Guilds is the title.
Oh,
that we
the
have.
Guilds. Okay, yeah. I have you. Yeah.
There we go. Piece called The Guilds from Colin McInerney's score for the documentary series From That Small Island, showing on RT television on Sunday afternoons. I just love that kind of modern, very modern string take that you have. And then the big, the lovely legato.
Exactly.
Tune
I
underneath
think the concept there is that it's a recurring theme for the colonialization that happens and the science of it, you know. So it was kind of like. It was like a machine, like a really kind of voracious machine. So it's kind of trying to evoke that sort of relentless march of this thing that is just consuming forest and territory. And at the same time, you have this veneer of beauty and, you know, sophistication, like if the Walter Raleighs and their silks and their finery. And at the same time, they're just hawing and paunching is one of the terms that is used, where they're disemboweling and, you know, not taking any prisoners and definitely, you know, putting down the Desmond Rebellion, like, and just the slaughter.
Yeah,
and,
there are very dark elements within the history as well, and you have to reflect those as much as you have to reflect.
Yeah, so and there is that kind of so that's definitely a recurring theme, how that machine manifests itself in different eras and different centuries.
And so you can then adjust the music in
exactly
slightly different instrumentation or slightly different take on it.
And you can go to major to minor, you know. So in a way, even by the time Daniel O'Connell comes along, the tune is the same, except we've moved to a major key. The tune is the same tune.
Yeah, because there's a little bit more emancipation involved in the O'Connell era. I want to finish up with, again, I presume this is a pre-existing piece, was the brilliant. Is it Mark Redmond again?
It is, yeah. There's wonderful Cormac Branagh and Mark Redmond and Maeve Ní Bheagaíoch and Ronan and Russell Snuddy. And
Ronan and Russell, I think, have probably given us some of the percussion that we heard in that
piece.
Yeah,
great. And Pierce O'Lurk as well sings Paddy's lamentation on one of the episodes as well. Yes, it's great to play with them as well.
Yeah, well, we listen to Queen Enail, which I presume is in and around the Battle of Kinsale and the Flight of the Earls,
exactly,
and all
indeed
of that,
yes,
and all of that type of thing. But before I do that, you've been working on this for a while, clearly, to get to get your four episodes. I mean, that's a lot.
It's definitely a lot of toast to be buttered.
Have you had time to organise a few gigs in the meantime?
Yeah, I'm heading to Akib at the end of this, so I have remarkably space on my hard drive, which is lovely. So I'm heading to Bobstock in Cape Clear next month. And the beginning of the month, and then I'll be at the Kilkenny Festival with Kate Ellis in July, and in Brittany with Blána Hauge there as well in July, and then I'll be in August. What am I doing? August is Kilkenny and Brittany, and then September will be the Sounds from a Safe Harbour as well.
So plenty to keep going over the summer period. Gurmino got Mahagatas Chalk
Mila Falta
Colomach Numera and Shin. And we'll finish up with the Queen in the Ale, played by Mark Redmond, as heard in the score for the documentary series From That Small Island. Pipe playing there of Mark Redmond, Queen in the Ill, as heard in the documentary series From That Small Island. Colin McInumera talking to us about that. The first two episodes of the series are currently available on the RTE player. Series continues on RTE One Television this Sunday and the following Sunday, and it is at 6:30 p.m. Now, it's an absolutely beautiful sunny evening here in Dublin, and I hope that all around the country, I hope the sun is shining. I want you to put yourself in mind of a very sunny day and put yourself at the seaside looking out on some wonderfully calm water. Half a century ago, we all learned to be afraid. Very afraid of the water. It was 50 years ago this week, Friday to be exact, that the world feasted its eyes on a prosthetic shark in the waters off Amity Island, while the great white feasted on them. Joining me to celebrate this seminal, groundbreaking, or should that be ocean-breaking film, directed, of course, by a young film-obsessed whippersnapper called Steven Spielberg, is Paul Whittington. I mean, I have to say, I don't know why they were worried about what the shark looked like. They had John Williams to create the best shark ever.
Yeah.
With a little help from Stravinsky, yeah, I would argue.
Absolutely, who I think was dead by that point, luckily for them. But yeah, no, I mean, I did watch this. It's so familiar to me as it is to everybody, but I watched it the other night just in preparation for this. And it's one of the great magic acts of cinema because it was a bad B picture. It was based on a schlock novel. It should have been, the sharks didn't work. It should have been a terrible picture, and it wasn't a picture. And the adversity of it was the making of Spielberg. And despite the rubber shark, it still works because of great performances, because of the suspense he builds with the help of the music and et cetera, et cetera. And because it's actually a much more adult film than one remembers. It's kind of salty. Mm. I mean, they took out, there was an affair in the book that they wisely took out, but it's salty. Roy Scheider's character gets drunk.
And, yeah, we've three leading male characters here who bring us through the story. So maybe if we explain who they were, first of all, or are.
Yeah, well, Roy Scheider plays the sheriff. He's not from there. He's from, as is constantly pointed out, he's from New York, the blow-in, and looks like it. And he's in this Long Island seaside resort that depends for its very survival on the July weekend and into August. And he's the sheriff. The poor woman is attacked at the start of the film, as everyone will remember, and then he decides to close the beach. Nobody's happy. They have to reopen the beach, and all hell breaks loose. Richard Dreyfuss plays Hooper, who is this oceanographer who comes to investigate what they might be dealing with, and gets out his measuring tape for the bite marks. There's all this wonderful hammy stuff for the bite marks, and tells him, you've got a big one, and Robert Shaw, the great Robert Shaw, who died a few over here in Connemara a few years after this film was made, he plays Quint, who is a local sort of fisherman and salty dog who nobody likes and who says he's going to kill the shark.
Well, so those are the three men, and we'll come back to where they were in their careers. Where was Steven Spielberg at in his career when he made Jaws?
He was at a very delicate moment. He felt he'd made a film called Duel, which some people may remember, which was very clever, and it was basically a bit like Jaws, actually. It was about a man being chased by a truck that doesn't say anything. And it was very clever, but it was pulpy, and he felt like he was falling behind people like De Palma, who he would have known. And he was desperate for a big film, and this had a lot of money poured into it, and he thought this could be an opportunity for him. But within a few days of the shoot starting, he thought he was in big trouble. He thought he was finished.
And was there enough in the previous film for him to be chosen for this, or was it a kind of a last minute necessity?
There was promise, and I think his relationship with George Lucas was probably helpful. Lucas had a sort of minor hit with American Graffiti in 1973, and out of that was coming something big, which people already knew he was working on. So he had a little bit of clout, and Spielberg was his friend. And in fact, it was him who suggested Richard Dreyfuss, who was pretty much unknown for the role of Hooper in this film as well.
And Roy Scheider wouldn't necessarily have been the first choice. He was a kind of a tough guy. And this chief of police, he spends the time sweating and worrying about what's going on.
Yeah, he's very nice, chief police. Yeah. He's worried about his kids. I mean, he does drink a bit, but nobody's perfect, Sean. But Roy Scheider had been, he was character actor, he was Golden Gloves champion, he was a tough guy.
Yeah.
Robert Shaw had problems with, tried to bully Dreyfuss, he didn't try and bully Roy Scheider. Roy Scheider had his most famous role to that point was in The French Connection with late Gene Hackman. And he was not the first choice for this either, but he was very well cast, and he showed that he could play something other than a tough guy in this, because he is the kind of the heart, he is you in the film, really. He's the protagonist in the end.
Yeah, I have a little section from the beach, and I think at this point they've decided the mayor is constantly saying, "No,
the mayor's great
to,
with his loud jackets and everything." Yeah,
we have to open the beach because of course he wants his votes coming in when the next election comes around, because the people don't have.
We
money.
Can see his point.
It'll be his fault if they don't get to open the beach. So there, I think at this point, Scheider's character is up patrolling the beach,
yeah,
watching everything.
He can't swim, by the way. He hates the water.
Yeah, so. Which Spielberg did as well, I believe.
Hated, very nervous. That's one of the reasons why he made the film, yeah, yeah, yeah.
An interesting kind of parallel there. So he's on the beach and you'll hear the kind of the general sounds of the beach, and then inevitably panic sets in. You don't really have to see the pictures to know that something bad has happened
That's the most upsetting part of the film, actually, because you'll hear somebody earlier on saying Pippin, Pippin, and his dog has gone missing, which is kind of like the sign that something worse is coming. And then this poor kid on a Lilo, we don't see it. He's too clever for that. Comes out, you see the Lilo go up in blood and the kid disappearing. And then afterwards, Brody, the police chief, is confronted by the widow. A very good scene, but it's so well done that.
Yeah.
And then the general panic, and you go to Roy Scheider's face, and he's like, "Oh, is this my fault?" You know.
And that is the wonder of it, is that kind of dilemma there, because you're watching his dilemma all the time, the mayor's dilemma.
Yeah.
And then you have these two, in inverted commas, experts from a very different kind of sides of the fence, if you like. The Quint character played by Robert Shaw, and what is his actual job?
Quint?
Hooper. Yes, Richard Dreyfuss' character.
He's an oceanographer. He has this big fancy boat with. He studies the sea. He studies sea animals, but he explains he's very wealthy. He's independently wealthy, so he just doesn't care except about the and he is very ahead of his time. He's very sympathetic to the sharks, who have obviously had a bad 50 years since this film came out. Their numbers are down about 70% for various reasons. So,
although they have been rehabilitated in recent times, I think.
Sharks are being wiped out by...
Their reputation has been rehabilitated slightly, yeah.
Absolutely, their reputation has been, we know we're supposed to like them now, and that, you know, if the odd Australian goes missing, it's not their fault. But so at that point in the film...
With apologies to all Australian listeners.
Yes, of course, at that point in the film, he had made the decision. There was these three mechanical sharks. They were supposed to be able to do this and do that and do the other, and he decided that he couldn't trust them. And he said
they lost a fortune on those these sharks that just wouldn't work. They kept sinking and cost a fortune. He referred to he was very nasty to the special effects department, I believe.
He was, and people actually, the crew thought this was a stinker and were calling the film Flaws instead of Jaws and everything like that. And it was really
he referred to the special effects as. Special defect,
which is not very nice, but he was exasperated, and then he thought to himself, he had a long dark night of the soul, and he said to himself, what would Hitchcock do?
Question to ask yourself as a film director,
because it was a thriller essentially and a horror film too, and he just said, everything is atmosphere. What you don't see is worse than what you see, and that's the secret of this film.
Yeah, and it's so the John Williams music that we heard, or that just scene as you described it, the Lilo. And thump, the Lilo disappears. You don't need to see anything else. That's more frightening.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more frightening, in fact. How much over budget did it go? Because there were other things that Spielberg insisted on.
It went three times over budget. They had a budget of $3 million. It went to $9 million. Well, one thing he insisted on that studio wasn't happy with, but which made it not a B picture, was shooting on location. not shooting in studio, because it totally changed the film and a lot of proper ambient sound and the atmosphere.
Well, that beach scene rather, you know, that has a real sense of reality.
Yeah, they're standing on a beach and you see the summer season happening in the actual town, which is not the town that is portrayed, and it's just you're there. It's a real place to you, and that all makes it more effective.
However, the three men on the boat is probably the kind of the heart of the film in some ways, and you have Schrader out there with both Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw. No love lost between Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss, or the characters, in fact. It kind of suited
the
two.
No, it was mirrored by the characters, and Robert Shaw was a drink with breakfast type of a guy, so he was not easy. He was very good in the film, but he was not easy. And he thought, you know, Dreyfuss, he didn't fancy him. As I say, he didn't try bullying Roy Scheib. He didn't fancy him, and he was quite hard on him. And Dreyfuss did say that he learned, who could be difficult himself. He did say he learned a lot from it, and maybe a lot of that tension helped that scene, because it is. One of the reasons it's not a B picture is because of these actors, and that scene is a
the scene. This is the scene where Quint in particular tells his story.
They're swapping scars in an amusing way, and then Quint shows his and tells this amazing story about the Minneapolis, the USS Minneapolis.
Yeah, and we'll hear a little bit of it because it's about 4 or 5 minutes long and kind of improvised, I think, for the most part.
To some extent, yeah.
Let's have a listen.
Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then... Oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in, they... rip you to pieces.
Robert Shaw there with a little section from his
lovely
speech.
Piece of acting.
It's incredible. And you were telling me as we were listening to that, Paul Whittington with me this evening, celebrating 50 years, believe it or not, of Jaws the movie. He tried that several times, I think the day before, in a fairly inebriated state.
And then he apologised, and he did it. He apologised to Spielberg, and which was unlike him, apparently, and he did that. And it must have been something to witness. They're all great in that scene. There was a softening of the characters in that scene, particularly Hooper and because they realised they had something in common. And then, of course...
things happen, but for those who haven't, who weren't there 50 years ago,
spoilers,
or 49, et cetera, years ago, whatever number of years it's been, 50 years that it's been on in cinemas and on the telly quite a bit, I suppose, along the way. But seeing it on a big screen with those big wide open vistas of the sea, that really is the way to see it if you can.
It is, and it has been, I'm not sure about now, but it has been re-released on numerous occasions in cinemas. It stands up really well, and obviously the bits that are problematic are the late bits when you see the thing, you know, bouncing off the boat. But you kind of get over that, and then you get to hear Roy Scheider say great lines
like
you get to hear him say, like, we're going to need a bigger boat. It's a funny film as well.
Yeah, it has a lot of black humour within it. The other thing that you have to talk about when you talk about Jaws is the summer blockbuster and what it did to the film business.
It transformed it. This and Star Wars transformed it. There was, this was considered by everybody, Spielberg and Universal included, a dog until they showed it in Dallas in March of 1975, and he realized that it worked. That somehow it worked. That people were buying into it. That people were fainting and so on. Some people walked out because they're upset. So then they decided, let's go for this. They decided to release it in the summer, which was very unusual because traditionally people are outdoors as they should be in the summer, not in a cinema. And they put a lot of money behind it. There was this viral TV campaign never been done before. People flocked to it. And it broke all sorts of records that would then be broken by Star Wars, and it changed the whole cinematic model for decades to come.
All right, and having watched it again, you'd say it merits several views.
Terrific.
Really,
yeah. Yeah.
That's Paul Whittington celebrating with us 50 years of Jaws, the movie, the big summer blockbuster back in 1975. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena.
Turn it up loud. You tried
everything, but you don't get it. When I thought I broke away and I'm feeling happy. It's almost 29 years since Tupac Shakur's glittering musical career brutally ended in a hail of bullets on Las Vegas Boulevard. In the years since, the rapper and poet's reputation has only grown. And in his new book, Words for My Comrades, Dean Van Nguyen explains how Tupac's roots in the Black Panther movement shaped his life and turned him into a revolutionary. Delighted that Dean is with me in studio this evening. And I started with that song for a very particular reason, Dean, because I think that is where you started with Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, I was in, I believe, HMV in the Square Tala, yeah. And it came up over the speakers, and I think it was one of those where I stayed to the end of the song, and then I bought the single straight away.
And I think it was on the album as well. Did you buy the album later on in events when Brenda's Got a Baby was there, or was that the B-side?
Well, Brenda's Got a Baby was the B-side on that single, but yeah, I think I went to school in Walkerstown, and like for us, like Tupac was just one of, you know, the guys. Mm. There was another group of kids who, like, Kurt Cobain was the guy for them, but for us, we gravitated towards the rappers. You know, Nas and Jay-Z, and we loved all those guys. And because at the time, I think Napster was around a little bit, but there wasn't too much MP3s or streaming at the time. So we used to pass around the CDs around the schoolyard, or you'd plug in a earphone and in the yard and try to catch something. Yeah.
And you draw in the book, because you look at his life, and we'll go to his early life and his family background, which is extraordinary and very interesting indeed. But you draw large parallels, and you quote a lot of Irish artists in this, not least of whom are Rubber Bandits and Blind Boy Boat Club, around the parallels between particularly what Tupac was doing in gangster rap and lots of what was going on in terms of Irish heroes.
Yeah, I think I started off the book, I kind of declared my own interest and my own relationship with Tupac. And I think that, you know, Ireland do seem to have an affinity for him. I talk about, like, the murals that you see around. And I mean, I had to cut out some stories about, for example, like, I went to a Nelly gig years ago and these kids were waving this Tupac flag around. And like, I realized, like, it was literally the only connection they had was they were going to see a show of a guy who was also a rapper, even though he couldn't be more different than Tupac. It was some way of connecting with him. But I think if you go back and you see, I think his reputation as this kind of late 20th century revolutionary and Irish people's affinity for him, it's kind of in a long line of connections between Ireland and the Black Liberation Movement in the US. So, like, Bernadette Devlin and the Black Panther Angela Davis would have been very close friends. It goes back all the way to, you know, Frederick Douglass and Daniel O'Connell's mutual admiration of each other. So, yeah, there was a Facebook group a couple of years ago that I remember would Photoshop Tupac into pictures from the 1916 Rising. And I think they used to end every post with, like, Tupac our law or something. Yeah. And it just seemed to make sense with him, I suppose. Yeah, he would have been a...
But there was a specific mural. Was it in Limerick that Blind Boy told you about the mural he saw down there, which again seemed to refer directly to Tupac?
Yeah, you see all... I think he was talking about, like, there was one with horses and rugby players on it. Mm. But I've heard about ones of, like, you know, like I said, Tupac and with Irish revolutionaries and things like that. He would have been a great man for storming an RIC barracks, I think.
Now, the other side of his life, obviously those Irish parallels are interesting to us, and it's part of what you explore in the book, how real or otherwise those connections are. But there is no doubting, you list off his lineage in terms of revolutionary movements and particularly the Black Panther movement.
Yeah, well, I think, like, the core premise that was driving the book was that how did this rap artist, like a man who made songs that people could listen to in the club, become associated with revolution, and how has his icon been to be so hugged closely by new social justice movements. So I think the starting point was definitely to go back to his Panther roots. So from there became this opportunity, I think, to tell this kind of 50, 60 year story that drew from, as I say, the Panthers through to
and particularly to mankind, his mother was important in this. She was in court when she was pregnant with him.
Right. Well, yeah, she was. So she was would have been a rank and file Panther. She would have worked on the breakfast program, which was a program that they had that delivered breakfasts for free for children in the neighborhood. Like, she would have been involved in tenant rent strikes, things like that. She ends up being arrested and as part of a group called the Panther 21, who are charged with a conspiracy to commit multiple bombings around New York City. Of course, they all claim their innocence, and this was a part of this clandestine operations by FBI and other government agencies to limit the Panthers, to crush the Panthers. So she ends up defending herself in court. So this is, at the time, the Panther 21 trial was the longest, most expensive trial in New York history. So for this 22-year-old woman who didn't have a third-level education, she was, and towards the end of the trial, she was heavily pregnant with Tupac. She'd been back in prison, in a prison that ended up being closed not that long after she was there because of the conditions, just kind of trying to safeguard her unborn child's health and at the same time defending herself in court. And she ended up beating the case.
Yeah, she won it out in the end. I must say, I love the sound of the Baltimore School for the Arts, where Tupac then went to school. He was in New York then. I think, did they go to Baltimore pretty much straight away after New York before he went further west over to California?
Yeah.
But the Baltimore School for the Arts, what a place for a young mind like his to be given free rein.
Yeah, because he was this, you know, he was an arts kid. Like, before he moved to Baltimore, he had performed in plays in New York. So he had the opportunity to go to this art school, which entry was completely based on your aptitude for the arts. It wasn't based on academics at all. And he really, I think, thrived there. Probably, I think he might have called it later on, like, one of the happiest times of his life. He was around other art kids. He, you know, studied Shakespeare. He was a big Shakespeare fan. I did visit the school as part of the research, and the woman who now runs the theatre department went to the school and was a friend of his at the time. So she was really great, a great source to talk to.
Was in Baltimore in that school of the arts that he met the woman who would his poetry mentor, who eventually became his manager, Leila Steinberg?
That was later. He moved to California after Baltimore. And yeah, she was one of the kind of early figures who helped facilitate him getting into music. But he was always at this, I think, at the same time, trying to connect whether he wanted his life to go the way of activism or music, because he was involved in these youth groups as well. He was the chairman of a group called the New African Panthers, where you can, on YouTube, you can dig up radio interviews he was doing at that time. He's still a teenager, that are really fluent and cogent and insightful. But I think he ultimately chose music because, well, it was his passion. And I think he also saw it as an ability to actually have an outlet for his activism and to, you know, get his message across and to reach even more people than he could.
He did live life in the fast lane. Things happened very quickly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I think the intensity of his life is particularly when you're kind of trying to chart his biography as for a book like this. And, you know, it's just this really extreme living and not just, I mean, his life ended up being a litany of court cases. He was incredibly prolific as a music maker, and which is why he left behind so much music. And yeah, I think if he lived
25, he died at 25.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, just because, as I say, he lived such an extreme life, and he left behind so much. And I don't think he could have kept up that pace.
East Coast West Coast feud, which of course soured all of the friendships between lots of rappers, and particularly the rival Biggie Smalls, that was the death of him, effectively, literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the wake of that, and like when Tupac and Biggie were both killed, and I think that was when you see rap really changes. It becomes a lot more glamorous, or a lot more glitzy. The Hype William videos from 97 onwards. And I think a lot of that was the artists who had been their contemporaries were just said, like, we can't keep doing this. We just lost our two biggest stars, our two most talented stars. And it's tragic, you know, we can't continue with this the way it's going.
You compare him, I mean, big comparisons to people like Che Guevara in your book, but obviously there's a contradictory side to this. He was this big rap star, and gangster rap was very much part of what he was doing. Having written the book, can you marry, because you even refer to Tupac the man as T-U-P-A-C, but Tupac the rapper with the numeral 2 and P-A-C. Can you reconcile the two things?
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of like art. You can separate art and the artists generally. I think that most of the time the artist puts too much of themselves into the art. And equally, some artists can use their art as an ability to, or at least their profile, that being an artist comes as a way of hiding themselves or from protecting themselves from poor behavior. So yeah, I mean, like the book is, it's there's a lot of dark stuff in the book, particularly the period of his life when he was on trial for sexual assault and when he was ultimately convicted of that. So yeah, I think what I set out to do when I started the book was I said to the publisher, like, I'm not doing the Walter Isaacson kind of biography of a great man thing, and I'm sorry not to shot fired at Walter Isaacson. I'm sure he's very successful. Yeah. He can handle it. But yeah, it was just important to me to
try and,
to cut to the truth of it. And with, you mentioned the Guevara reference, but I think what I was driving at there was his Tupac. His, as the further we get away from his death, the more his kind of icon and symbolism grows, and more the man kind of disappears behind that. So as well, and the book was a little bit of an attempt to start to kind of prevent the flattening of his life and more just to kind of cut to the heart of who he was.
Thanks for telling us about it. That's Dean Van Nguyen, and the book is called Words for My Comrades, A Political History of Tupac Shakur. It's published by White Rabbit Books.